لامودی هوری ارز لامودی هوری ارز یتر سبو یر کوی یتر سبو یر کوی یتر سبو یر کوی بانگو گیر کامبا ایسابر بانگو گیرگا یتر سبو یر کوی
That's Ali Farka Touré, the great Ali Farka Touré from Mali, along with Toumani Diabaté, with something called Sabu Yerkoi. This is Lead Stories right here on the greatest internet station ever, PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, January the 22nd, and with the pomp of yesterday's festivities gone, we're back to the reality of rather unpleasant circumstances. We'll talk about that later in the program. But first, the United States today began airlifting French troops and military equipment from a base in southern France into Bamako, the capital of Mali. France, seeking materiel and other support from its allies, including the United States, continues with its military counteroffensive against Islamist forces that had occupied the northern part of the West African country. France currently is a lead actor in retaking Mali, its former colony, from a collapsed government, a military coup, an internal separatist movement, and an incursion into by reputed al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamist rebels from neighboring states. But France's intentions are far from honorable, says our guest, journalist Gilbert Messier. Thank you, Gilbert, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to introduce you to the audience. Gilbert Messier is the editor-in-chief and one of the co-founders of News Junkie Post. That's right. So people, you heard people being news junkies. He's one of the originals. He also is a journalist.
Indeed.
Photojournalist. He's now based here in the United States since 1983. And one international recognition and praise for his coverage of New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Well, Gilbert, the situation in Mali is extremely complicated in that there are so many actors involved and so many acts involved in this deadly drama that is unfolding. So let's talk a bit about the pieces of the puzzle, and then you will get to your theme for today, which is, could you tell us what your theme is today? Give us a short theme.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's Mali has really the potential to turn into an African and Middle Eastern Afghanistan, but bigger. Much bigger, because it involves a regional situation, and it has to be put into the context of what's going on elsewhere, not only in Africa, but also in the Middle East. It has to be put in the context of a NATO intervention in Libya last year, and the toppling of Gaddafi using Islamists, and it's also in the context. Even so, the U.S. is now helping, as you noted in your introduction, giving some logistic help to France There's definitely a little bit of a rivalry here between France, the former colonial power of Mali and most of West Africa, and the U.S., and of course the new major player in the region, which is China.
Hold it right there for a minute, because you gave us the overarching theme. Okay. Now, let's talk about the separate different dramas that have affected Mali and that have brought us to this point in Mali right now. On the one hand, we have you mentioned already that it was a colonial entity colonized by France. That's one piece that we got out of the way. The other fact is that in recent times, just last year, in fact, Mali, having endured a relatively long period of stability, it was always a poor country, but it had been stable for a while, and then we had a military coup. Could you pick us up from there and just give us a fast overview, because you'll have to come back another day and we'll discuss each of these in greater detail,
oh,
I should say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you know, just to give a little bit of a background on Mali to your audience, the population in the north are mainly Tuareg, and Tuareg are they consider themselves more Arabs than actually African. So basically, Mali was sort of in a sense like a lot of those colonial countries. Kind of a figment of the imagination of empires, such as, in the case of Mali, the French Empire. Basically, the borderline, okay, the Tuareg, is a population of about roughly 2 million people, okay? And they are sitting across the border from Mali, Niger, and Algeria and Libya. Okay, so the Tuareg have fought one way or another for their independence and secession for years, and this is just one of the issues. I mean, what is a complete mess in this puzzle is that one side is split, and the other side is split as well and has various interests. For example, I was mentioning the role of the U.S. in this mess, in creating this mess, because the captain that is part of the Malian triumvirate right now, his name is Captain Sanogo, was actually trained and groomed by AFRICOM, and he's the one that did the coup against President Touré in March 2012, okay? And his justification for the coup was, as a matter of fact, that the president was too weak to handle the separatist movement from the north, from the Touareg. Now, the coup has made the Malian army very, very weak and split. Captain Sanogo is a Green Beret, and now there's conflict between Green Beret and Red Beret, which are the paratroopers. So basically, either willingly or unwillingly, AFRICOM has created a mess. And your predecessor said that actually the French are acting on the behalf of the U.S. Well, it's not completely true. The French are actually acting to defend their own interest, which, as I have written in an article on News Junkie Post, is about resource, namely uranium. Because France depend, 75% of French energy rely on nuclear energy, and the key to nuclear energy is, of course, uranium source. So that is really the caveat for the French action. And it's all, you know, sugar-coated under the name, of course, of war on terror. But there's a huge contradiction here because the Islamists that they are fighting in northern Mali, they actually used them in Libya to topple Gaddafi, and they are using them now in Syria to topple Assad. So it's sort of like, in a way, for the pseudo-socialist Hollande, there's like good Islamist in Libya and in Syria and bad Islamist in Mali. So it doesn't make any sense at all. It's a huge contradiction.
It is very, very hard to understand. It's because there's so many component parts to this hot spot now, and all parts, you know, have some degree of dysfunction about them. There's internal fighting, like you said. The Tuareg, who had settled toward the northern part, wanted and still do want their own country. They want to take that piece of Mali for themselves. They are more,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Trish, but that is purely legitimate. And as a matter of fact, the Tuareg should have had their own country at the end of the colonization by France. And that country should be that area, should be the original geographic area. It's kind of the same thing, you know. I'm making that analogy with Afghanistan because it's the same thing than for the Pashtuns. The Pashtuns, which sit between Afghanistan and Pakistan, were created this time by the British Empire, by basically splitting the Pashtun into those two new countries.
The continents or the subcontinents, we find that these artificial lines of demarcation were just drawn, and it, in many cases, as it has throughout the Far East and in Africa, you have a number of skirmishes resulting out of that that have gone on for generations because they just arbitrarily drew a boundary and said, okay, you are on this side of the river and the other folks are on the other side of the river. So, you know, it's the classic case of the Hutu versus the Tutsi kind of thing.
Exactly. And it doesn't, it's not based on tribal line. It's based on basically people drawing maps either in Paris or London at the time, and drawing that completely arbitrarily without any kind of worry and concern for the real tribal affiliation in those countries. And that is the problem for Côte d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast, for Senegal. It's a problem all over Africa and in Congo as well. And as you noted, you know, with the Hutu situation, it is a sort of the bad dream, the nightmarish situation that colonial power, including my own, because I feel ashamed for it. I'm a French citizen. We have created, and we have created for, you know, hundreds of years.
Now, what was the strategic value of Mali to France?
Historically,
why did France enter the picture at all in Mali?
Well, you know, we Mali was the colonial push of France in West Africa dates from the started during the Napoleon III, started during the Third Empire. Basically mid 19th century, okay? And the Tuareg basically are a nomadic population that were controlling the transit, okay, of various merchandise, not necessarily a very good one, by the way, because they are not completely innocent. They were running the trade of ivory, they were running the trade of gold, but they were also running the slave trade from, Black Africa to the Middle East. Okay? So the Mali and all this region is really, it's sort of like the transition between Africa proper, which is the south of Mali, and the Sahel region, which is the connection to Algeria and the interests of the French Empire, which used to be the French Empire in North Africa. So it is critical. It is absolutely critical in terms of the position of the country.
In recent years, though, what has the relationship been, and why is there a renewed interest in Mali? Why has the France taken the position that because of internal problems, a collapse of a government, again, the situation with the Tuareg fighting for their own independence, they want to carve off the northern part for themselves. We had the collapse of democracy, as they call it. And so the French are coming in, hopefully, they think, with the robust support of the European entities and, of course, the United States, to, as they say, to retake the country. What does that actually mean?
Well, it leads to a really, really bad situation. And actually, the move of Hollande is starting to get, even so most of the French media is actually applauding, because it's sort of like a way to Hollande was passed for like a technocrat, and he got elected on the belief that he would be not as like Sarkozy, he wouldn't have this sort of like testosterone charge sort of mentality, but it's a way for him to show that he can use military action. So it is, in a sense, it is a political, it serves a political purpose for Hollande in France to show, well, guess what, you know, I'm not sure if I can use this term on the radio, but I do have balls, you know. I can do like Sarkozy did in Libya. You know, we have an army, and we can use it. And it's also a way for Hollande to showcase the French military gear. I'll give you an example. On Tuesday, Hollande went to the Emirate and managed to sell 60 Rafale jet fighters. That's a lot of money. So there's a different agenda, but Hollande is starting to get critique from within France. The former Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin, was the Prime Minister under Chirac, was highly critical of Hollande, saying basically that this falling into this the war on terror scenario was a huge mistake. Basically, Mali, thanks to France and the U.S., has been made, and Captain Sanogo, an ally of AFRICOM, has been made into a failed state. And there's a reason for it. The reason for it is it's easier to control a failed state than a state that is actually stable. Under President Touré, the man that got unsettled by the putsch, Mali was perfectly stable. Before the intervention of NATO in Libya to unsettle Gaddafi, Al-Qaeda in this region, the Islamists, were not as strong as they are now. I mean, I was on Russia Today, on RT, not that long ago, and I pointed out, about a year ago, I pointed out that what the U.S. and the West was doing in the Middle East was basically to provoke a Talibanization of the complete region. We are creating more Afghanistan. And, you know, as we, I'm saying, the West, the U.S. in the lead, but also France and the other country from the West. And that is just the reality of it. And the African countries, the Middle East, are picking up the tab. They're paying the price. We are wrecking those places.
Now, what is the connection? Could you explain the connection between the fall of Libya and the rise of the Islamist movement in Mali?
Oh, well, the connections are absolutely direct. Agence France-Presse today, that is today, reported that the Algeria hostage taker were actually helped logistically by Libyan Islamists. Okay? Libyan Islamists are in Mali right now. They have used a bunch of weaponry that were stolen from Gaddafi arsenal, okay, to the rebel in northern Mali. Okay? Part of the people fighting, that colorful bunch fighting in that coalition of Islamists and Tuareg separatists, one of them, his name is Ag Gali, and he's the head of an Al-Qaeda-linked organization that's called Ansar Dine. And this person was one of the mercenaries used by Gaddafi. Gaddafi used a lot of Tuareg mercenaries, okay, when he ran Libya. And Gaddafi was also, in some of his policy, was also a tenant of the independence of the Tuareg in Mali, because, of course, that was a way for him to create trouble for the former colonial country, France. So he was always pushing that. But unfortunately for Gaddafi, the very same people that were supposed to actually help him ended up, you know, toppling him. It is so complex, and people are switching sides so many times. There's also now the role of Qatar in all this, and Qatar has been financing. It's been proven a few months ago. Has been financing the Islamists in Mali since actually the 80s. They've been building madrasas. They've been running like some Qatari NGOs. And their goal is to sort of do what they are doing in Egypt, what they did in Libya, what they did in Tunisia, and what they're trying to do in Syria, which is to spread Salafis, to spread Islamists, Sunni Islamists, radicalists, and they also have the goal to, to get their hand eventually on the very attractive oil gas reserve of Mali, as well as the uranium, of course, and the gold. So there's so many people fighting there's so many players that it's very, very complex, and the one that are going to end up picking up the tab, they're already picking up the tab, because in Mali there's close to now 1 million refugees. Okay, the one that are picking up the tab are people from the African country, are people in Libya, in Syria. They are the people picking up the tab of those incredible geopolitical blunders.
Now, what, from your observation, because you've been following this rather closely, what is likely to happen next? What do you see as a next phase in the entire situation? What developments are likely to occur?
Well, on a military standpoint, okay, the way it stands right now, France has about 2,500 troops on the ground in Mali. They are the only one really fighting. The Malian army is sort of, well, they're sort of, you know, they're there, but they're not really doing that much. The Algerian, a lot of people are paying lip service to France. Algeria is saying, well, yeah, we will open our airspace, but we're not going to send troops. Germany, France, the EU partners are doing the same thing. They're saying, yeah, we support your action, you know, but we're not going to help. We're not going to have troops on the ground. So France is basically going to be stuck, okay? Because Hollande has defined... Hollande is basically saying we're going to stay as long as it is necessary. And he has defined three main goals, which are to stop the terrorists seeking to control the north of the country, to secure Bamako, which is the capital of Mali, and that is especially concerning the fact that there is 6,000 French nationals in the south of Mali. And another third goal, which is, of course, very vague and very ambitious, which is to help Mali retake the territory of the north. But what I think we're heading for, what should probably be negotiated at the UN, is some kind of partition of Mali, because it might be the only way out. Well, the Tuareg, part of the Tuareg are actually secular, where the Tuareg, it's namely the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, the Tuareg would be granted an independence from the rest of the country. That is probably the best case scenario to avoid a bloodbath, or to avoid for France to be in a complete quagmire, because the U.S. is not sending troops. They're basically giving, you know, logistical support by air, using a few drones, but that's about it.
On another level, Gilbert, is this the Islamicization of Africa or the Arabization of Africa?
Well, the thing is, you know, I'm very glad that you raised that issue, because it is there is definitely and it's unfortunate for Africa, and I can tell you that from my own experience, Islam has not made life for African any better. And a lot of the problems that are rising in, for example, Ivory Coast, in Nigeria, and all over Africa, are basically conflict between Muslim population and either animist or Christian population. And those conflicts take a really bad turn. And that is where a country like Qatar and Saudi Arabia come to play, because they have a lot of money and because they practice sort of a proselytism to basically make Islam spread. And namely, their brand of Islam, not some kind of, you know, moderate Islam, but Islam, Salafis, fundamentalism Islam, which is horrible for women, which is horrible for a lot of people, implementing Sharia law. I mean, there's report coming from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, both of them, that the northern part of Mali, controlled by the Tuareg and Al-Qaeda, there's report of amputation. The Sharia law said that if somebody steals, you can cut their hand. A report of like a you know, stoning of women. Horrible things that are filtering through. But again, you know, it's sort of like a way to a way to stir a bad situation in those countries. It's a way to manipulate those people to have access to their resources. And if Qatar and Saudi Arabia do it through Islam, the West and America do it through military force, and you know. But it's kind of all about the same thing. Ultimately, it's about the access to resources.
Now, Secretary of State, she's still Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is to appear tomorrow before a congressional committee to testify with respect to the attack on the U.S. Consulate or mission in Benghazi. If you were on that committee, is there a question that you would have for Secretary of State Clinton with respect to the connection between Libya and Mali?
Well, I mean, the connection between Libya and Mali and the attack on Benghazi is obvious. I mean, basically, it is kind of, it's a replay of the strategy of Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. in Afghanistan in the 80s. It's like making, you know, calling the terrorists, the Islamists of today, were called back then freedom fighters. And for like about a few months, that's what they call the Libyan, you know, revolutionary. Just like the way they call those incredible, you know, Syrian revolutionary in Syria right now. They are the same. And just like in Syria, where there's an element from Al-Qaeda in Iraq fighting, okay, against Assad, financed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and helped by the West, and approved by the West, France, namely, and the U.S., that's what happened in Libya. We basically, they got involved in a situation that they didn't really know to get rid of Gaddafi, to put the hand on the oil, and created a really awful situation for the Libyan people. Not that Gaddafi was a great guy. Far from it. Gaddafi was a dictator, but it was still a better situation for Libya. It was sort of like more stable. Not a great situation, but stable. So if I was, I don't know. You know, I would probably get kicked out of that questioning if I had a chance to ask her a question. But it wouldn't be very pretty. I mean, basically, they are creating their own monsters constantly. That's what I'm trying to say. They keep creating them, and it is appealing. I mean, the only person that is speaking out in the Middle East about the French adventure in Mali, and it happened today. It is Morsi, the president of Egypt. Okay, he spoke up today against the intervention. Okay, and he did it for one reason, because he is a part of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is a sort of, well, they consider a mother right now, but that is new. They're actually sort of fundamentalists in their own right, and they have charters all over the Middle East and all over Africa. And they are supported by Qatar. So, in a way, I think what Morsi is saying is what Qatar is not saying, said, we want France out.
Well, we'll certainly return to this subject again, but you gave us a very, very healthy and easy to follow. I mean, even with all of the threads leading all over the place of this piece of fabric. But thanks so much, Gilbert Messier, for joining us today. Gilbert, again, is at newsjunkiepost.com. Thanks so much, Gilbert, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, and hopefully we can do it again.
Yes, we will, certainly. Well, we'll take a break and come back and talk about madness in Washington, D.C., right after this. Oh, yes. That was a great Ali Farka Touré. He passed away, unfortunately, but was considered the premier blues man from Mali, and was able to spread his wonderful music all around the world. All around the world. He was fantastic. And, of course, we hear the Kora also picking up the wonderful vibes from Ali Farka Touré's guitar. You're listening to Lead Stories here on PRN.FM, and I hope you're doing your homework and passing the word, because we have to grow this station and make sure that at least 45% of Americans are listening to it by tomorrow. Okay. Well, let's do this. Just a short comment, and we'll have time for your calls at 1-888-874-4888. Of course, President Obama officially is now into his second term, and yesterday was remarkable, and we do know how. One thing the United States does know is how to throw a party, and they threw a very impressive party yesterday. That's great. And despite all the speeches and, you know, people wondering what will Mrs. Obama wear, and oh my gosh, doesn't she look the epitome of style? Look, you know, come on now. That lady has all kinds of people just begging her to wear their clothing. So it's that reason. And she always has had a sense of style. So give me a break for that stuff. But, you know, despite all of the speechifying and all of the swearing in and all of the pomp and circumstance, we find ourselves confronting the same realities as, in fact, we did 4 years ago. The unemployment rate today in 2013 is exactly the same as it was in 2009 when President Obama was sworn in the first time. That's a sober backdrop. So never mind all of the, you know, all men are created equal and all this is great. Somebody wrote the speech, he reads it. But we have to wonder what is going on in Washington, D.C. when people are still insisting on presenting a reality to us that we know is not real. It just isn't. The president says we're all in this together. I beg to differ. We're not all in this together. Some people are doing exceedingly well, and the vast majority of people are suffering. So we're not all in this together. There are people in the United States doing fantastically well, better than at any other time in history. The vast majority of people are suffering, and this government doesn't look like it's capable of paying attention to the people who are suffering. With an average unemployment rate of 7.8%, conservatively, the unemployment rate among African Americans is 14.0%. Now, if 7% is causing a crisis, what's 14%? And it's been double and triple that of the national average unemployment rate. And you could pay attention to all these various constituencies. The president points out all these different groups that he intends to address. But Mr. President needs to understand that this is his fifth year. Never mind all this stuff about people thinking it's, well, we have a good chance to start. No, you had a good chance to start in 2008. That's when you started having your good chance. We're now into year five, and we ought to hold this president absolutely accountable, call him on every single misstep that he makes. I'll take a call. Richard Wolff, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us, Richard. Are you there? Oh, Richard isn't there, so I will... No, he's not there. I'm sorry. But this is what we need to pay attention to. We need to remind Congress that it has done nothing, literally, for the entire past administration. The people's business did not get done. So why am I supposed to be in some kind of euphoric state that we are now in a second term, and I'm supposed to believe that miraculously all these things that didn't get done when the grounds went, you mean you had absolute power because the people voted like crazy the first time. And if after all that support, with that groundswell of support, we got zero, close to zero done, what should we hold out as hope in this second term? It should not be lost on anybody that the person he referred to as the preacher, who spoke so eloquently on the mall, the preacher was not a legislator. But the preacher got a lot of work done and got a lot of bills passed that benefited a lot of people in the United States of America, especially the poor. That preacher, in no small part, got the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed. That preacher, in no small measure, got the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed. That preacher got the Housing Act of 1968 passed. And he was not in Congress. Okay, so these are the sobering aspects. I'm sure if you listened yesterday, you listened to a Martin Luther King who was not joking. He was not dreaming at all. And he talked about reaching very often a point of sadness about the situation, that the task was so awesome and he felt so finite against infinite opposition. But he persevered. Not because he was dreaming, but because he was busy organizing and working. And I resent the president telling people, well, we have to do this together. No, that's why you were elected. You were elected because you said the mantle should be given to you. Give me the mantle so that I could get the job done for you. Well, we gave you that 4 years ago. You got it. You have the power. And you're head of the Democratic Party, technically. You are head of the Democratic Party. Whip your folks in line and get some work done. Don't tell people about, well, you know, this is a grand dream and we have all these things that we want to do, but we must work together. No, the people already did their share of the work. They lifted you up and put you in a position to get the job done. And instead of putting the screws to the people, at least do something in their behalf. That's the problem that we have. All of a sudden, we're supposed to write off the first 4 years where nothing got done. Nothing got done, really. And here we are with unemployment rates, especially the African-American community. I keep telling folks, this community has been really, really screwed on almost every level. It is in crisis, and it's beyond crisis. It's practically in meltdown, unemployment, at bad education, you name it. It's there. Homicides. More African-American children are killed every year than soldiers in Afghanistan. That's a fact. And don't come out there now and tell me that you're going to ignore all of that and you're going to go for the grand picture, the grand picture. And you dare to stand at the same place where Martin Luther King stood, and you're standing symbolically before Lincoln. Well, he's your hero, he's not my hero. But you're standing before Lincoln, aware of your place in history, and that's pretty much all. This is not about your personal journey, Mr. President. This is not about what a lucky guy you are. This is about whether you actually understand that people have put fully vested in you the trust that you would exercise a leadership to get things done to help the poor and working poor people of this country. Well, I'll stop there for today, and thank you very much for joining me. I hope you found something that you could latch on to and ruminate on until we meet again tomorrow at the same time. Do tell a friend, and let's get this PRN.FM, Progressive Radio Network, let's get this to be on at the fingertips of everybody you know. Okay, that's your homework. So we'll join each other tomorrow. And thank you so very much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Bye-bye.
Isabel Bangu Gerga, Eter Sabu.